fly on out of here and leave you. And so till next time, we'll just say adieu and leave you with this.
where I have to really call Ernesto.
Is he?
You can say that. I can't even get myself started here.
What happened?
My headset volume, getting his microphone and my microphone into the headset. Welcome to the first show on KPFT HD3 of Think Wing Radio. We've been struggling with the control board a little bit here, but we're going to get that under control, we hope. We will be able to take possibly phone calls at 713-526-8735, and I will be periodically monitoring hashtag ThinkWing. The topic for today is going to be Islam. So the question is, what do you think of when I say the word Islam? Do you think of the Middle East or the Crusades or Palestinians or oil or religion or history or terrorism or peace or justice? Or do you just kind of shrug your shoulders and go, I don't really know? So today, because I think that the last response is the most common, I want to talk a little about Islam, try to get a little bit more realistic picture, more multifaceted picture of Islam, of what it means, of what it means to the 1.5 billion people who follow it as a faith, and what it means to the billions who share the planet with Islam but are not believers. In the United States, Islam is often talked about in very one-dimensional terms. It's either a religion of jihad or it's a religion of peace. I personally know very little about Islam as a faith. I've done the Wikipedia Cliff Notes check, which I'm sure leaves a little to be desired. But I personally have never been satisfied with the level of discussion that I have heard in terms of trying to understand what Islam is, what the Quran says, how jihad may or may not relate to it, or what kinds of jihad may or may not relate to it. The purpose of today's show is not to be a religion class or a history class, but in a sense, maybe to make your ideas about Islam and its relationship to the West more complicated rather than less complicated or more simple. My guest today is Mustafa Carroll. Since June 2010, he has served as the executive director of the Houston chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, otherwise known as CAIR, C-A-I-R. They do have a website, care.com.org.
Carehouston.org.
Okay, carehouston.org would be the local chapter. There is a national website, which is care.org. So carehouston.org, one word, CAIRHOUSTON.org. Okay. I wanted to make sure I got that spelling right while I was live on the air with all of my other distractions with control boards. I'm not a control board guy yet. CARE is the U.S.'s largest Muslim grassroots civil rights and advocacy group with 35 offices nationwide and also in Canada. Mustafa's goal, self-professed, is to be the consummate community servant. He strives to build blossoming relationships with ecumenical community and government leaders in an effort to create an environment where all people can work together for the common good. For further information about CARE, as I was saying, you can visit their website at www.cairhouston.org or go to the national site at www.cair.org. So welcome to the show, Mustafa. It's my pleasure. Let's start with something simple. In English, the Islamic holy book is pronounced Quran. The proper name in Arabic is
the Quran.
Oh, I've heard it.
It's an Arabic word.
I've heard it pronounced Quran or something closer.
Uh-huh.
Okay, but
yeah,
we're not going to try that because that would just confuse me more. So with appropriate apology, I'll be using the English. Now, I guess the first question that I want to discuss is Islam is considered to be what is called an Abrahamic faith. Oh, and by the way, you're listening to KPFT HD3 because I have been so confused with this board here that I may have forgotten to do the ID. This is ThinkWing Radio with Mike Koenig. My guest is Mustafa Carroll. So Islam is considered to be an Abrahamic faith. What exactly does that mean?
Well, Muslims believe that, you know, that Prophet Abraham, may God's peace and blessings be upon him, is considered the father of faith. He's not only considered the father of faith for us, but for, you know, the other great traditions, i.e. the Jewish and the Christian scriptures as well. And he was beloved because of his obedience to God, that Abraham had the faith of many, and that his faith transcended what we may even think of faith, because he was willing, if you remember the story in the Bible, and the Quran, where he was asked to sacrifice his only son. And his only son for Muslims is Ishmael, because Ishmael was the only son at that time. All right, I know that that's a theological difference.
Yeah, and we don't entirely want to get into a religious education here, because that I don't think is our ultimate purpose for this particular show.
But that's what, and for us, Abraham is a prophet and a beloved prophet of God. Muslims consider him, as we do many of the prophets, to be Muslim. Muslim means someone who submits their will to the will of God.
And apparently Muslim and Islam, again, Wikipedia, have the same etymological roots in terms of one being a conjugation of a word, the other is a conjugation of the same word. So for people that wonder how you get the word Muslim from the word Islam, I'm sure it's partly in the transliteration from Arabic to English, and you kind of lose the obviousness of the etymological
root.
Well,
Islam means, submission to God. So the person, or the noun, is Muslim.
And that's Muslim with a U, not an O.
Yeah, Muslim with a U. Right? People write O,
In very broad terms, what would you say that Islam has in common with Judaism and Christianity? You made an interesting comment in terms of the Bible, and then you said in the Quran also. And I think it's important to talk about the commonality between the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the chapters of the Quran. Essentially, you've got the first book, the second book, and the third book, to put it in Judeo-Christian terms. So there are a lot of similarities.
Right. We share many of the same prophets, the same angels.
We all believe pretty much the same as far as, the outcome of what our religion is supposed to do. We do have different theological differences, probably less.
They're interpretive differences.
Interpretive differences, definitely less with the Jewish people than we do, or the Jewish faith, than we do with the Christian faith.
Now, Islam, in the Jewish religion, you have the Talmudic scholars, Talmudic scholarship. And as I understand it, the Talmud is basically generations of scholars trying to adapt the original teachings of the Old Testament to changing times.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, among Orthodox Jews, you're not supposed to light a fire during the Sabbath, and turning on a TV or turning off a TV or using a light switch because there may be a spark or some small thing. On a Talmudic level, that is considered building a fire.
Mm-hmm.
There is an equivalent in Islam where I believe there have been scholars who have tried to take the teachings of Muhammad, and over the generations have tried to adapt changing times to those teachings. And there is a word for that, which I do not remember. There's a specific name. You don't remember it either.
No, I don't.
I wish I'd taken that as a note.
Well, I'm going to tell you, because in most of the scholars I know, in the things that I've read, the scholars actually are trying. It is us that have to adapt to Islam. So even our culture, when you become a Muslim, or if you are a Muslim, any kind of cultural practices that are not in sync with the religion is superior.
But the religion is influenced by the cultures in which it arose. One of the similarities that I saw when I was doing my admittedly cursory research is, just like Christianity, which spread very rapidly by adapting local customs like the winter solstice and the spring equinox and the fertility rites and all of these different things, Islam did much the same. But, of course, it was working with a totally different set of cultures. So what might have looked familiar to us still looks strange to us in Islam, because we were never familiar with those cultures, either pre-Islam or post-Islam.
Right. Now, there's a lot of there's some things. I think every religion, people bring their culture. I don't know if it's correct to say that Islam adapted the culture to bring the people.
Because, no, I would agree with that.
Yeah, but people bring.
But there are things in Islam that don't address things, and at that point you get the equivalent of the Islamic Talmudic scholars trying to figure out, okay, given the teachings of Muhammad that don't address this specifically, and given our customs that we have felt are acceptable to us over our generations, where do they fit together? How do they fit together? Is that fair?
Well, a little bit, but it can be a little bit more. Islam is not as, I would say, we do address things, but the rubric, or the rubric for addressing those things, is the Quran. And so what scholars do is to look at it in a broad sense, but we always try to keep this main line to the tradition of the Quran, because culture can change rapidly. as is in our country. You can see that the cultural shifts and changes in how people live, how they do things, how far they get away from their religion influences their culture. And ultimately, it challenges the religion. And that's what we see now. And so it is with Muslims and others, too.
What I think is kind of interesting is, one of the things that I think is interesting is you've got different denominations of Islam, like you have different denominations of other faiths. Mm-hmm. Now, given my Jewish heritage, I know you've got, like, in Judaism, the major denominations are Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would presume, as opposed to assume, mm-hmm. that there is an equivalency in Islam, that you have some people that are very Orthodox in their practice, and then you've got degrees of relaxation, not because they believe less in the Quran, but people being people, you've got various levels of orthodoxy and practice. And I assume the same is true of Islam.
Yeah, it's not as defined because I'm very familiar with the Reformists and the Orthodox and some of the Hasidic groups, et cetera.
Yeah, there are a lot of different groups for such
and
a
we have
number.
Different groups. You know, probably the major schism or the major difference is the Sunni and Shia. And the differences are not that great, but that split had to do with who succeeded the prophet, who was going to be the leader after the prophet's death. The Shia group believed that the prophet's cousin Ali should have been the successor, and the Sunni groups believed that prophet had chosen Abu Bakr Siddiq.
In a sense, this is a very human kind of problem that arises after a founder of whether it's a faith or an empire, or mm-hmm. a nation, or a tribe, where once that person passes off the scene, now you get to human interpretation. So as precise as the Quran seems to try to be,
mm-hmm.
there's still room for interpretation.
Well, people will do that, but, you know, we're taught to do it in a scholarly fashion or to adhere to the scholar's interpretation on certain things.
But, of course, you have the term self-described sometimes before a word like scholar.
Well, no. No, we have.
I mean, within Islam, recognized scholars and recognized authorities. But then you have people who simply claim it.
Well, there are some people that claim it. But, you know, it's pretty clear about what a scholar means in Islam. Islam is a person who has been actually trained and has been educated as a scholar on the religion. And there are people, as you say, that are self-prescribed leaders, I would say, or imams. And imam and scholar may not be one and the same. All right. It's like a preacher in the church is not necessarily a scholar of Christianity. All right. But he's a preacher. And then you have lots of those.
And there can be, in some cases, very relaxed standards for being a preacher. I mean, there are a lot of different ways people can found churches.
Yeah.
So you've got the very recognized denominations, and then you have these little ones that pop up here and there that have their own version of Christianity, whether it's Presbyterianism or various kinds of Protestantism.
Absolutely.
Or sometimes something totally snake handlers.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got a lot of variation
there.
There's
a lot of variations, right.
Is there a comparable, I guess not a comparable level of variation within Islam, but there are a lot of different sub-beliefs within the major denominations of Islam.
We have some. I think I haven't come across something that's really that many that have branched away from the main tenets of Islam. There's a few groups, but in terms of...
Do they have names, I'm curious?
There's some Shia sects that have different. There's some Sunni sects that have a difference. You know, the interpretations in terms of how strict or how close to the word you adhere. And there's those kinds of variations. But in terms of, you know, the basic tenets of the religion, you know, belief in one God, belief in all the prophets of God, belief that God is supreme, so forth and so on. You know, we don't have as many deviations in that. And when you do have one that looks like it's a real deviation from it, you know, Muslims have an issue with it.
Yeah.
And I'm suspecting.
And I think this is true in
any religion.
In the Orthodox portion of any faith.
Yes.
I'm going to do a quick station ID. You are listening to KPFT on HD Channel 3. You can also go to kpft.org, and there is a link to listen online to the station. There is a Twitter feed. Let me check a second. Well, there should be a Twitter feed, hashtag ThinkWing, and I will try to look for any tweets that you might send me, and my computer has rebooted. So, you know, this is our first day. We're working this out. Okay, let's get back to business here. I think many Westerners, because Westerners, I think, as a group, know so little about Islam. It's so outside their cultural experience and their education.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like Islam is a very demanding religion. If you're going to follow it with orthodoxy, it seems like Islam is a very demanding religion. Some might even call it, they might perceive it as a very controlling religion. It really mm-hmm. talks about very micro aspects of life. Can we discuss that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, Islam is a religion of balance, justice, peace, and obligation. I mean, and when we say, we don't say that Islam is compelled or compulsory, that it's an obligation once you believe it to do certain things. And so, therefore, anyone who accepts Islam is obligated to follow its tenets. Now, those tenets can be demanding. I don't know if that's a good word or not, but it's better than controlling, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah, demanding. It is demanding, it, but it depends on the virtues of the person that accepts it or the person that's practicing. If, for example, you know, if before I became a Muslim, and, you know, I'm a revert, as we say.
A revert?
Yeah, a revert, because we believe that everybody's born Muslim. That means you're born, you know, willing to submit to God, and then you choose otherwise. But before I became a Muslim, it depends on my habits in terms of how demanding that religion is. It's often not as demanding for someone who willfully accepts it. And that's the only
way. Well, I guess demanding is relative. If you do it with comfort, it doesn't feel demanding.
It's not demanding.
If you feel sort of more compelled, perhaps because you've been brought up and you feel like your parents are saying, you got to do this, this is how you have to do it, and when. It can then feel demanding.
It can be any time people are not accepting the faith of their free will. And I don't know anyone that can. I don't think that's possible to say that someone can accept it. It hasn't happened in the history of the world. People usually accept it wholeheartedly. They have to accept it themselves. And then if you have a lifestyle or habits that actually challenge you, say that if I was drinking and carousing and I was clubbing every night, etc., and then, you know, you come into Islam and it says, okay, you can't drink, you can't chase wild women or any women for that matter. There are certain things you can't do. And this might be a struggle for you because you have this history, personal history of habits and things. That you had found challenging to do. So, yeah, it is obligatory. And once you accept it, you're obliged to follow it. And it does appear to be demanding because most people are not many people, I should say, are not doing what you do or living like you live. And people they're a little bit more loose, you know, in their lifestyle. So, you know, to them, you look like you're really strict. To you, it's a normal way of life. But for people looking from the outside in, it looks really rigid, strict. You can't date freely. You have to marry. You have to, you know, provide for a family. It's a real conservative lifestyle.
Within Islam, how can I phrase this? Is it sort of an all or nothing proposition? I mean, we talked a little earlier about the equivalency of reform, conservative, orthodox. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, Orthodox Jews don't consider conservatives or Reform Jews to actually be Jews.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it kind of rolls downhill like that. The conservatives kind of look down their nose at the Reforms, and the Reforms can't figure out what the Reconstructionists are doing. I mean, but you've got all of these groups that have some level of recognition and validity and legitimacy, even though there are disagreements within the groups.
Mm-hmm.
Any comparability within Islam?
We have some really strict forms of Islam, i.e. the Wahhabi or the Salafi groups that I know of that tend to be a little more strict or seem to be a little more strict. I can't say with great certainty that they are more any strict than anybody else, but they have some things that make them a little bit more strict than others. They tend to be a little bit more, you know, in that manner that you're talking about. In general, you know, the religion is open. Each Muslim has a, you know, obligation to study for themselves, to know God for themselves, and to practice faith independent of anybody. I mean, you know, once you become a Muslim, you, the only person that's watching you is God and you. And between the two, that's where the obligation falls.
I'm probably going to get into some other stuff in a minute, but I do just have one more question in this mm-hmm. sort of area. Has there ever been anything like a reformist movement within Islam, either currently or in the past? And if there was, what was the outcome of that?
Well, Islam is a reformist movement itself. Okay. But
what we're talking about something that has a very strict lifestyle followed to the letter. So I'm talking about, you know, like reformed Jews. It's like, okay, we can eat shrimp, even though it's technically not kosher. We're not going to worry about that so much.
But we don't. Our diet's not well. We
halal and kosher. They're actually very, very similar. Actually, one of the things I ran across that's interesting, and you can confirm whether or not this is accurate, mm-hmm. that food can be considered halal. That herbivores, mm-hmm. their meat can be considered halal, whether they are slaughtered by a Muslim, a Christian, or a Jew, as long as the proper rules are followed.
Yeah.
Halal does not have to be generated strictly by a Muslimist or Muslim butcher or processor.
No, in fact, before we had so many halal meat markets, it's considered halal for us to eat kosher food, kosher meat. That's where the rabbi pronounces.
Or you might say it's kosher for you to eat halal.
Whatever.
Whatever.
Yeah, but no, before it became very popular.
Ethnocentric point of view.
Oh, yeah, but it became very, it was always known that, okay, is it kosher? And we could eat kosher meat. It has to be, you know, anything where God's name is pronounced over it when it's killed. And that's it. So if the rabbi blesses it, or, you know, or whoever butchers it, in a kosher style, then that's okay for us also.
And I guess really that's part of what we're trying to accomplish here with this show is that even though the various religions that all have to share the planet one way or another, nobody's going away. Mm-hmm. So since we all have to share the planet together, I think it's worthwhile to see, in spite of the differences, where there is the overlap.
Yeah.
Where there is the commonality, instead of always looking for the differences.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that struck me as interesting is that Islam shares the notion of heaven and hell with Christianity, which in actual Jewish tradition, there is no heaven or hell. That's something that sort of came later, mm-hmm. I think, influenced by Christianity.
Yeah.
So there is a line in the Quran. I actually cited this because I thought it was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The quote goes, and it's 99, I guess, chapter 99, verse 7, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So whoever does an atom's weight of good will see it.
Mm-hmm.
And whoever does an atom's weight of evil will see it.
Yes. And that actually points to the Day of Judgment. You know, that Muslims believe in what's called in Arabic the Akira, which means the day when the dead will rise and be judged for their deeds. Moreover, Muslims believe that when you're born, that God puts two angels with you, one on your right and one on your left. The one on your right advises you, and the one on the left records your deeds. So when you die, you won't even be able to, you know, your mouth, your nose, your ears, your eyes, everything will be a testament for or against you. So there is such a thing as, and we believe in a heaven and hell that is real as the place we're in right now. So there is such a thing, and you will be judged according to your deeds, and that those deeds determine, you know, your penance or whether you spend time in hell and whether you go to heaven, etc.
Now, what I was given to understand from my, again, cursory reading was, I think a lot of Westerners kind of smirk at the notion that when they hear the description of Islamic heaven, that it's this place of fleshly delights, and you get all these virgins, and you talk about, well, you know, where all these virgins come from, and what's their version of heaven. But I think what I came to understand a little better is that is a metaphor. That is a human fleshly metaphor. It doesn't describe the actual concept of Islamic heaven, mm-hmm. but it's sort of a way of somehow describing the heavenly heaven.
Yeah, and that's a weak hadith. I don't think many Muslims go. I never even heard of it until recently when some of our detractors
I think in Western culture that is a very common understanding. Yeah. So, to the extent that we need to correct that, let's try to correct.
Well, it's a hadith, but it's weak, and there's a lot of, you know how people write things, and it just got in the mix in terms of that. There's some descriptions of heaven and hell, but it's usually described as the Jannah or paradise, etc. This 72 virgin thing, I hadn't heard of until people start talking about it. And I said, oh, what is that? You know, so I'd look it up, but it's considered a weak hadith. But there's a real heaven, a real hell. It's supposed to be paradise. If you, whatever you were doing here and good, if you had a good life with your wife, then you more than likely will meet your wife in the afterlife and this type of thing.
So in that sense, it isn't necessarily so different from the Christian notion
of
heaven.
No, it's not that different.
So that's interesting.
Yeah, but it's seven levels of it. Seven levels of hell. The thing about in Islamic theology is that the concept of eternal damnation doesn't exist in that way. That you serve time in terms of what you did, and it's up to whether God is forgiven.
So you can graduate.
You can actually leave it. And there's some hadiths and there's other verses that actually talk about that. But that's not, we don't know who that person is. We don't know who it is that's going and not going. Only God knows that. And so when what Muslims do is you're supposed to live your life in a way that you hope, because faith is something that you can't fake faith. You can fake dress. You can fake coming to the mosque. You can fake praying. But faith, belief in God, is something that only you and God knows. And so that's where the rubber meets the road.
Let's get a little now into intercultural history, because I think that's where a lot of the conflict between the West and the Islamic world comes from. In some ways, the early history of Islam resembles the early history of Christianity. Early Christian converts were persecuted by the Roman pagans, and early Islamic converts were persecuted by the Arabic pagans. So, common martyrdom?
Well, yeah. Well, you know, when you think about it, the pagans worshiped many gods. In Mecca, they worshiped over 360 gods. And it became Mecca was a center for commerce. And part of that commerce was the pilgrimage and to these gods. So here you have, you know, a person who comes along, Prophet Muhammad, may God's peace and blessings be with him, comes along and he brings something different. He says that we need to believe in one God. And that itself is really a political statement. And so the majority populace, you know, of course, you know, you're going against the
grain. Well, the Jews and the Christians face the same problem.
Same issue. And challenges for Prophet Jesus. Challenging who says that I'm not God? I mean, because Caesar was God at the time.
Yes.
So now you
every emperor
Caesar.
Became
yeah,
a
emperor,
demigod.
Pharaoh, all of that.
Yes.
And so, you know, it was the same, very similar in terms of it. And it took years.
So I guess it wasn't just a religious challenge. It was a political challenge.
It was political.
It's a way of challenging the divine right of kings, however you want to phrase it for some given historical period.
Absolutely. And so the prophet happened to belong to a very powerful tribe, the Quraysh, and his uncle, Abu Talib. He was his mentor and his benefactor and so forth. And he was powerful. But the heat became so heavy on them that people tried to dissuade him from bringing that type of message. And in fact, his uncle did. And he told him, he said, well, if you put the sun in one hand, the moon in the other hand, I'll never give up this belief. And at that point, you know, the uncle leaves him alone because he sees the sincerity of the prophet. But yes, they were persecuted and actually ultimately left Mecca for Medina in what we call the Hijra, had to leave. And he went to Medina and they established a charter there with everyone, with all of the different groups. The first constitution of Medina, which meant that everybody would defend anybody who came against all of them. And that was a very progressive step. And then return.
when you look at the history of Islam with the West, a lot of the friction doesn't necessarily have to do with religion, except that religion may have been an initiator. So you have the Crusades,
mm-hmm.
where the Europeans, over a couple, three centuries, numerous times, sent invaders.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they may have been religiously motivated or at the higher levels also politically motivated, motivated by attempts to gain wealth and rebuild the Roman Empire, whatever the various motivations were.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, memories are long historically. The whole Balkan conflict basically is about grudges 1,000 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So people remember. And when you talk to a Muslim, someone from North Africa, the Middle East, and you talk about Christianity, I think for them, one of the first things that comes up is the Crusades. They don't mm-hmm. see it as the positive thing that it is sometimes taught as in Western education.
Well, you know, we didn't hear anything really negative until probably, I guess it started back in the 70s during the Iranian-Iraqi and that conflict, the Iranian crisis. And then, of course, with 9/11, everything ramped up. But for Muslims, you know, the Christians and the Jews and the Sabians and all this is part of the Quran. The Quran says these are people of the book and to be respected as such.
And actually, in the early centuries of Islam, it was a lot more tolerant place to live for, let's say, a Jew than parts of Europe
were. In fact, Jews are, there's one of the oldest communities in North Africa, in Morocco. There's a strong Jewish community that has always been there. Egypt, the same thing.
Well, when Isabel and Ferdinand in the late 15th century chased the Jews out, they went to the areas controlled by Islam.
They chased everybody out.
Yeah, they chased or burned them.
Yeah.
One or the other.
Yeah, you had to become Christian or die. Or
you might
whatever.
Say light or flight.
Yeah. So one of the things that I try to warn people about is getting into this, what I consider a religious wild goose chase. We generally are trying to understand the issues in the Middle East in terms of religion. So we spend
a lot more than that.
Yeah, we spend a lot of time talking about religion when in fact it has very little to do with religion. The underpinnings of issues in the Middle East have to do with power, control, land, resources, as it were. And so has it been with the world. The Crusades were about Europe being in the Dark Ages. So, you know, to bring them out of Dark Ages, you have to have a good cause and a reason and okay, let's go reclaim the Holy Land and we'll bring the holy wealth back with us and this type of thing. So it wasn't just an issue of religion. People often see it like that because, you know, the heads of those or the head of the church or whoever says that, you know, this is God is commanding us to reclaim this. This is God. These people are enemies to God and so forth and so on. So I try to warn people that, you know, people are people all over the world.
Yeah.
So if you
for better or worse.
Yeah. So if you think that the reason that somebody living 15,000 miles away, the reason that they're mad at you is because you think different. Think again, because nobody cares what people think a half a continent away from them. Nobody.
Well, there are always going to be ideologues, but I think for the vast majority of people, actions speak louder than words.
Yeah, nobody is getting up and saying, oh, let's go get them because they think different. So we have to be careful about that. They are real life issues underneath all of this stuff that we talk about. There's wealth, there's oil in the case of the Middle East, they're a threat to the world's resources. That's one of the biggest resources in the world now. And if we don't have it, you know, it's going to change our quote unquote way of life.
Yeah, I think that the oil thing is the main reason most people will acknowledge that there's any interest in that part of the world at all.
That's it. If it wasn't for that, we wouldn't be there.
Right.
We wouldn't be having this conversation.
I believe that.
Yeah.
Sharia law, a political and cultural boogeyman among American conservatives. I would like to put this in the context of Sharia law, Old Testament law, and civil or secular or English common law, whatever you prefer to call them.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of conservatives use this notion of Sharia law where they talk about, you know, a hand for a hand, an eye for an eye, and, you know, we need to be Christian nations. And I don't think these guys have paid a lot of attention looking at crimes and punishment in the Old Testament. They're not that different. You could argue that there are aspects of Sharia law that strongly resemble the recommended punishments for various infractions that you see in the Old Testament, that what we think of as quote-unquote Christian law is really English common law, civil law, secular law that has evolved mostly in the last 400 or 500 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Sharia is more than punitive law. It's not a punishment system. And I think when you say Sharia, because people have been taught different, that, you know, we have a $40 million a year industry going around telling people that people are bringing Sharia law and they're going to cut off hands and heads and your daughters won't have rights and all this other garbage. And so when people hear that, if that's all you hear, that's what you think it is. Sharia is much more than that. It's considered technically sacred law. I mean, law from God that tells you how to live, etc. But it's not a codified set of laws. It's not a set of books that says you do this and you do that and you do this.
Which kind of gets back to my Talmudic analogy.
Yeah.
Where there has been a lot of interpretation based on history and culture and pre-Islamic traditions that have sort of evolved over time.
Yeah, but in Sharia, it's totally based on the Quran and the Hadith.
Where the Quran specifically addresses it.
Yeah.
Which is where you get into interpretation.
Right. But you get into stuff and it talks about it's to protect your rights as a citizen. It's to protect women's rights. It's to protect, in fact, most of the cases in the countries where women have been abused, they've taken Sharia to court to show people how that's not what they're supposed to be doing. It hasn't worked against them, per se. Now, you do have some places where people have these real loose interpretations of it. But one of the things is that it's not a codified set of laws. It's actually how we live as Muslims, how we, you know, how we treat our fellow person, how we treat our parents, you know, our charitable works, how we manage our wealth, how do we give to the poor, so forth and so on. So it's not what people think it is, but it's been used as a bully pulpit and to launch warfare on American Muslims, pretty much, and Muslims around the world. That 1.5 of them billion are people who think that you need to die, or they can treat you bad because of this so-called law.
I think that now it's kind of time. We're getting down to about the last 10 minutes of the show, 8 minutes. Time flies when you're having fun and having trouble mm-hmm. with the control board. And I really want to get to this issue of jihad and jihadists and where they see their justifications for their actions and where other Muslims say that they are actually acting contrary to teachings of the Quran. Can you help us out with that?
Well, first of all, jihad comes in three levels.
Well, there is a translation. I mean, basically, it's just the rules of war.
Well, jihad is there's a physical war, of course.
Of course.
But the main struggle, it's jihad means supreme struggle. The main struggle is with self. It's actually controlling the desires of the lusts of the self or the temperament of the self, etc. So that's number one. The physical war that people associate with jihad can only be done in defense. It's not something that you can do arbitrarily. You can't just go out and fight people because they think different than you. And all the examples that we've read in the Quran, it talks about how jihad, it gives the example of wars that were fought with the quote unquote unbelievers, but those unbelievers actually committed treason or were traitorous or actually attacked the Muslims. And in that case, you have a right to defend yourself. In fact, the Quran says oppression is worse than slaughter. Now, somebody who straps on a bomb and blows up innocent people is criminal, even in Islamic standards. This is no such thing. In fact, the rules of war in Islam are even more strict than the Geneva Convention, because when people went to war, the Muslims went to war, they were told not to destroy any trees, don't tear down buildings, that you have to only fight those that fight with you, don't kill innocent women, men, children, non-combatants, only kill those animals that you're going to eat, etc. So, you know, the rules of war were definitely more strict than anything that we know in this century. You couldn't just bomb places and blow it up and say, well, OK, we're at war with folks. It was immoral.
there seems to be some differences in thought between free will and predestination in mm-hmm. Islam. And what I was reading is, on the one hand, God, Allah, and it's interesting to note that, it was pointed out to me that if you are an Arabic speaker, whether you are a Jew, a Christian, or a Muslim, the Arabic word for God is Allah.
Thank you. I'm glad you said that, because many people think that it's the moon god of Arabia or something else.
He's not some other deity.
No, absolutely not.
It's just the word
in Arabic. For God.
And the word is different in Farsi, and the word is different in Urdu. But the word we know, Allah, is simply a word that means the same thing.
Literally means the worshipped. And if you know an Arab Christian, that same word is in an Arab Bible.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was important that we mention that.
Mm-hmm.
This notion of predestination, where God knows what's going to happen, and yet at the same time, you have free will. To me, that seems a little bit cognitively dissonant. And I'm wondering, to the extent that we talk about jihadists thinking that what they're doing is fated to be, and on the other hand, thinking that they have free will to do it or not, I find that confusing.
Well, you know, the thing is, I think let me clarify this jihadist thing, because everybody, that's a word that other people create.
And let's focus on that.
We don't even have that word. That word, a jihadist, doesn't exist with us. Jihad exists. And jihad for the Muslims doesn't mean what it means to everybody else.
Okay, well, let's talk about that.
But jihadists, just like Islamists, I never heard that word up until a few years ago.
Interesting.
There's no such word that we use, but people use it as a derogatory term to when they speak about Muslims. Number one, we believe that God is divine. That means there's no equal partners. The devil and God are not equally yoked or equally the same. The devil doesn't cause bad and God causes good. God causes everything. God is over everything. So for us Muslims, we believe in supremacy of God. That means El Qadr, that God is the one that controls all the destinies and so forth and so on. You have a free will, because that's the only way that you can function as a human being and someone who actually is going to embrace God or embrace Islam. You know, if you didn't have that, you'd be like the animals. The animals don't choose what they do. They just do what God has already programmed them to do. But you have the will to accept or not. And so did Satan. There's a similarity there, because in Christianity, this concept of the fallen angel. Well, Muslims don't believe he was an angel. He was one of the jinn race. This is another creature, and he was created of fire. And the reason he was.
And this comes, I think, out of pre-Islamic tradition.
Well, I don't know.
The notion of jinn.
Jinn? It sounds like Al-Qaeda.
No. D-J-I-N-N, I believe,
okay.
is the English transliteration.
Yeah, but it's in for us, it's just J-I-N-N.
Okay.
And it's one of the creations. God created jinn, angels, and men, right? One was made from fire, that's jinn. The angels are made from a light, and man is made from clay. And the angels don't have free will. The angels do exactly what God tells them to do. So when God sends the angel of death for you, the angel of death doesn't.
They click their wings
and they go, and that's it. But jinn and men have free will, and this is what caused jinn to degenerate. That he wouldn't bow down when God created man, and said, I'm better than him. I was created from fire. He's from earth, blah, blah, blah. And so it goes on.
It can be a very hard thing to wrap your head around.
Yeah, but now free will is something. It's not, I don't think it's really dissonant. It's just we have a free will to do what we do, but God is going to determine our fate. God knows when the final hour. God knows all about you. You can do, it's just like your...
So it's kind of like macro management and micro management. You get to micromanage, God gets to macro manage.
Yeah, at the end of it, that's it. At the end of it, the day, God is going to determine whether you were a believer, non-believer, whether you did good or bad, etc.
We have a couple of minutes left. We're going to sign off at approximately 3 p.m. Because I'm the last show scheduled, we get to do approximately at 3 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
Mustafa, is there anything you would like to say in summary before we wrap up the show?
Well, I think that in summary, I think that if people want to know Muslims and understand Muslims, because I get calls all the time from people who I know have never met a Muslim. And I remember back, you know, a few years ago when we were having, when our racial issues were at its zenith, most of it was I went to college with guys who had never saw a black person, never talked to one.
When I moved to Houston in 77, yeah. I was the first Jew many people had ever met.
Yeah, never saw him, but they knew everything about him. And you know, and that's the sad. And to me, you have to get to know people that you're going to find in my life. I found that you're going to find good and bad in most groups, in almost every group, and the majority of the people are going to be good folks with good intentions.
And I think that comes back to what we discussed at the very, very top of the show, that I wanted to de-simplify Islam. I wanted to help generate a more multifaceted view of the complexity of Islam and the people that follow Islam.
Yeah, it's not all a one thing. You have some, you know, I kind of detest people saying, oh, Islam, religion, or peace. Well, the religion's not on trial as far as I'm concerned. Islam and Muslims are not always necessarily the same. All right, just like Christianity and Christians, not always the same. Jews and Judaism, not always the same. The religion says one thing, the person may do something else. Not everything that a Muslim does.
And sometimes you rationalize things you want to do in the context of what you feel you should do.
Well, you rationalize your bad deeds.
Exactly.
Yeah, and people do that all the time.
All the time.
But, you know, I want to share just one stat with you, that I was in a meeting just a week or so ago that had some of the FBI and the Department of Justice persons, et cetera. And I brought the question to them. I said, you know, I did some research. And according to your research, since 2011, only 6% of the so-called terrorists or terrorist wannabes were Muslim. And the rest were non-Muslim. My question to them is, why are you spending so much time on a community that commits less than 1% of all crime in America, that actually have done, you know, more good to this country than anybody else, than many groups? I shouldn't say anybody. Why
at least as much?
Yeah. Why are you investing your time? And here's 94% of the other folks who are actually committing more terrorist acts than the Muslims are. But you have all the energy is spent on so-called Muslim terrorism. And they would, their answer to me was, they won't talk to us. I said, oh, is that simple?
Yeah,
So my point is that I think that people need to get to know Muslims and meet some, et cetera.
And understand they're just people with a different faith.
Yeah, people, and they got the same kind of issues that go on with everyone else.
Okay. I think that's going to wrap it up for today. Thank you, Mustafa Carroll.
Thank you for having me.
I kept wanting to say the other name that I keep getting wrong. Mustafa Carroll, Texas Executive Director for the Council of American Islamic Relations. Mm-hmm. You can visit them online at cairhouston.org, or you can go to the national website, cair.org. Mm-hmm. And you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Channel HD3. I thank you very much for listening. I hope that you've maybe gotten something out of the show.